I just wanted to say that it takes a small band of dedicated people to change the world, Margaret Mead, and I think that dedicated band is here because we all have that spirit of activism. And, you know, it's not that everybody has the means to donate, but when you donate your time, listen to somebody. And then, you know what, you write. Like, you know, all of us here, we blog, we write. And then it's not that where do you have the time, you just have to do it. Because we need to think something beyond ourselves. So that is something I'd like to add also. When you think globally and act locally, you think of something beyond what you have to do. So this is a way we give back. So, you know, the next speaker, last but not least, is Dr. Kathy Falvo, who is the past president for Physicians for Social Responsibility. Current president of Physicians for Social Responsibility. She represents the PSR at the United Nations, the NGO representative. And I have had the privilege of knowing Kathy for like more than 15 years. She's a great friend and a mentor. And she's a baby duck. That means she's a pediatrician. And also in prevention and public health. She's had a very interesting career as chair of public health, professor of pediatrics, and, you know, a peace activist. And Kathy is now the president of the International Society, International Society for Doctors of the Environment. And, you know, Kathy has worked in Nicaragua, Haiti, and Vietnam. And then we were in Australia together because Australia had the first public UN conference on global public health 3 years ago. And Kathy received her public health degree from Columbia University and her MD degree from the SUNY Upstate. And she's also worked with the USPHS Indian Health Service on the Turtle Mountain Reservation in North Dakota. And the fun fact about Kathy is she also went to Galapagos and took some great pictures. So without much ado, Kathy, the floor is yours. Your time starts now. Thank you.
Okay. No conflict of interest. Thanks for the introduction, Minnie. And being last on this panel really sort of mucks me even more than 2 months ago now. When I was in Nicaragua and they asked me to talk to a bunch of teens about what teens wanted to hear about, which was sex, drugs, and rock and roll, which is all fine and well as a pediatrician and a public health person, you do a lot of that, but a bunch of parents showed up. You know, in the States you go, Mom, some things you shouldn't hear, wait in the waiting room. There you are in the church backyard and you can't tell the parents to leave. But we did it. It was actually lots of fun. But what to talk about after my predecessors on this panel was really a little difficult. Plus, the concept of think globally, act locally, which is very widespread, has always created some problems for me because I really, in part, got started in international health when my patients in the neighborhood health center in New York City would have all these problems that you just couldn't handle, and I'd go, you come from countries where they have, you know, at least primary health care that's free, why don't you go back there to get this very complicated problem sorted out that I don't know what to do with in New York City. I mean, I know how to handle it, but not get through the bureaucracy. And they go, Doc, you have no idea. So I took myself off to Haiti to work to get an idea of what they were talking about. And this concept that you're going to learn more than you're going to do, even as a physician in a very resource-poor, medical resource-poor country. Haiti is pretty poor in almost all resources except people. Has to be kept in mind. So what I wanted to talk about was a little about the bilateral learning that resource-rich countries like the U.S. need from their professionals that you can't get here. And it's already been mentioned, Leishmaniasis you almost never see in this country, although I have seen a few cases, all imported. But if you haven't been abroad some, you're going to miss a lot of things and you're not going to know what to do, whatever your branch of, you know, the health profession is. So I'm going to bring some examples from the hospital Albert Schweitzer in Deschapelles, Haiti. This is their front exit, that entrance, that's more what it looks like most days. The first day I was there, there were 200 kids waiting to be seen. For four of us, three, only one of whom could speak Creole. It was a daunting idea, but we did it. And this is part of why it's so daunting in Haiti, which is really hard to imagine until you get there. The country is 75%. The landmass is mountains, not hills, mountains, you know, 5,000 feet. And that's it. The top picture, this one, is the hospital, which is not quite that light because you have these huge overhangs to keep the sun out, but is very bright and cheery. The biggest problem that probably there, the two biggest problems in terms of health is one, water. There's very little of it, and none of it is potable. The hospital is in the Artibonite River Valley, which is the main river and water source of the country, unless you drill down a lot of feet. And one day we took an inner tube ride down and collected up water samples, all of which, among other things, grew typhoid. But people use it for drinking water, so it's no wonder it's a huge problem. And one of the first things that Dr. Larimer Mellon, who started the hospital, did was go build wells all over. And the other big problem is the landscape, which is makes it very difficult to get around. They have clinics, they have, not clinics, but dispensaires, sort of health stations in varying areas in the area that the hospital serves, and at least once a month, one of the doctors from the hospital goes up to the dispensaire to see what's going on, to do some teaching to the healthcare workers up there who are high school graduates, that's a requirement from the local area, who get training at the hospital once a month, a six-month program, and then once a month. But one of the stations we went up to, which is not the farthest one, we start at 5 in the morning, 45 minutes bouncing through mud, and then 2 hours hike up the hill just to give some care, to give some advice and some care. So it's not easy, and you really start to appreciate what people go through to make a living, to keep trying not to die of very preventable diseases. Now, these two pictures, this little kid, and I'm sorry it's so blurry, but there's never much light in the hospital to take pictures. If you can look at his upper lip, because I'm afraid I'll... there's a big black area there. And he developed fever overnight. And fortunately for him, the Haitian doctor was on call, who rolled over in bed on the local telephone service that the hospital set up and said, give him lots of IV penicillin G, and went back to sleep. The older fellow there came in with that great big lump on his neck that had started a couple of days before, and they were about to take him to the operating room on the assumption that this was a usual infectious abscess, when he developed a fever, and then it broke down and got a great big black scar. This is anthrax. which we now in the United States have a very little bit of experience with, but is the government said when the anthrax first started here, probably almost nobody in the United States has ever seen a case. It's a very common disease in developed, or not very common in developing countries, but it's certainly there, and it's any place that there are animals. We actually have anthrax in this country, but it never gets to this stage. Texas is currently having an outbreak among cattle. North Dakota and Minnesota, South Dakota do every few years. And it has to do with not treating, in this country, cattle, most of the world, goats. When the disease starts, instead of burning all the carcasses that are infected, which is what you really need to do to get rid of it, they get buried. And what gets buried comes back to the surface. And these kids have one of the major killers in the world, although it's very rare in this country, but it's not going to be, that big swelling on the neck and the crusted area here are both the not usual presentations of tuberculosis. I see some people nodding, but it sort of always struck me as interesting. My infectious disease training has all sort of been on the job. I never did a fellowship and all those official things that American doctors do. But when I was at New York Medical College, the infectious disease people routinely called me when they had funny x-rays, because I was the only one there who'd ever seen much in the way of tuberculosis chest x-rays. They'd call me when they got patients from overseas with fever and go, and what do we do? And you go, what's the time of year? Where'd they come from? Think of these things. And only because on my vacation time, I'd gone abroad. Now, I'm going to give two more cases from there and then bring up the discussion I really wanted to do. The picture on your right is a sonogram, which is very advanced technology in Haiti. This is a sonogram of the heart of a three-month-old who came in with fever and shortness of breath. But what the doctor on call got very excited about and why he called pediatrics was because the kid had a very, very loud heart murmur. And it turns out, let me see if I can do this without making a mess here. This little black space over here is a hole between the ventricles and his heart. And it's a ventricular septal defect, 4 millimeters, very small, which means it's going to make a lot of noise. And it turns out it's not at all the cause of his shortness of breath, which he'd had from birth, which we didn't figure out. But one of the things, lessons from this is a sonogram, which they can do in Haiti because the U.S. has donated a lot of their old sonogram machines because it's outdated technology. It's very cheap to do this. It's very easy, and it settled a whole lot of questions in very short order for what would be almost no cost anywhere, because sonogram machines in their heyday were not that expensive. In the U.S., it's CAT scans and MRIs, all of which you can do in 5 minutes at the bedside. So we really have some lessons to learn. And this last one, which doesn't show up very well on the big screen, looks fine on a computer, is a peeling finger on a newborn, which the U.S., when I was a medical student, which is a very long time ago, everybody who came to the hospital got a test for syphilis done. And somewhere along the way, we stopped doing them, because the yield was close to zero. This is congenital syphilis in one of its many, many forms, all of which I saw when I was in Haiti, and none of the other which I have photographs of, because if you don't take it, when you see the patient, by the time you come back with your camera and they've had their first shot of penicillin, it's gone. But it was really interesting because I got back to, I was then working in the neighborhood health center in Ossining, and one of the family docs came to find me instantly. She said, I have this 2-month-old with this rash that keeps peeling and won't go away. And it looked just like this, except it was her whole body. And her mother said, when the baby was born, she had red spots on her hands, which, at least when I went to medical school, was syphilis until proven otherwise, because almost nothing makes red spots on your the palm of your hands and the palm of your feet. So I called her obstetrician, and she said, and I told the obstetrician this. So I called the obstetrician and went, what are you guys doing? How could you miss this? And he said, we don't do tests anymore. Nobody has it. These diseases all exist in the world. To get from Deschapelle, Haiti, which is on a good day 2-hour drive from Port-au-Prince in the airport, is not more than 4 hours from U.S. mainland. And there's no place in the world, we keep saying, which is more or less true, that's more than 24 hours away. So the tuberculosis, syphilis, measles, leishmaniasis, and all these other things, cat and malaria, which are major killers in the world, can and do arrive in the United States in one way or another, and we need to recognize them. We need to know what to do with them, and we need to never forget that until they are obliterated the way we have mostly the smallpox, except that some virus still exists, so it's not total done. Until we've killed off all these varying and sundry infectious diseases, they will and do come back here periodically because we stopped looking. And so I think we really need to think about when we think globally, act locally, is to remember that what's local goes global. So what's local in Haiti ends up in the U.S. And the rest of the world. And of course, much of what the world has in disease came because the Europeans took it on their travels with them. So we need to think bilaterally all the time. And to talk about what local areas that aren't your own need is really, I think, not legitimate unless you go there and do some work, not just go and take a look around. To believe statistics from the world is a dubious enterprise because you probably all learned somewhere along the way in your career just how data is collected, which is samples here and there and then extrapolated, which has not much to do with reality. And to understand these things, you need to look globally before you can act locally, because a lot of things that happen in the least developed countries actually are very useful to know in the most developed countries in terms of rethinking how we do things here. In Haiti, when you make hospital rounds, the question is, why did you do that test? What did it do for the patient? In the United States, is why didn't you do that test? It exists, it might help. And so to really learn to think and to do things in a rational way, you need to be bilateral. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Falvo. And before I open the floor to questions, we have about 22 minutes. I just wanted to say another example. Well, the cholera outbreak in Haiti was traced back to a Nepali peacekeeper who came to Haiti to work. So that, again, is an example of the downside of globalization. So in every way, whether it's food safety, we really need to, you know, think locally, think globally, act locally, act globally. So that being said, the floor is open for questions. You're very welcome to come up, stand up, introduce yourselves, and if you have any question for any of the panelists or in general, please go ahead. Please make sure you introduce yourself by stating your name and where you're from. Thank you.
Caitlin Jenkins. I'm from Charleston, South Carolina. I actually had a question for you, Dr. Murphy. Could you expand a little bit on the use of the cell phone with contacting some of the pregnant mothers? In the work that I do, we work with parents as well. But in our population, there's a high overturn of cell phone numbers because there are low economic status. Could you just kind of expand on kind of like, do you ask for more than one number or?
Thank you. Thank you for the question. I mean, the ones I know about, that's what I'll be able to talk about, not generally. Well, the one in Malawi, which I said was started by the founder of the Stagecoach USA, she's based out of Scotland, is every woman is given a cell phone if she cannot afford to buy one. If she has one, she is given the cell phone recharge card because plans are different. It's not like here where they add on minutes. And there is a list made up of these women with the cell phone numbers. And so what happens is if they need to go to the hospital because they're in labor, and Malawi, and I think Elvira, you will, you know, you visited there, it's very hilly. So the terrain is not that favorable for, you know, these women to walk. So they send a text message, and this driver is paid not only for like a monthly retainer fee, but for every woman he brings to the medical center. So that is how it works. And in addition, the midwife has a cell phone too for that particular community. So that's, and they really kind of increased that because one of the big issues is when women deliver without, you know, a skilled birth attendance, we know that a higher incidence of fistula. So for this particular, the Freedom from Fistula, who's been focusing on safe motherhood and preventing fistula, they've really found this effective. Now in Zanzibar is again the same thing. They usually, the one cell phone number was the woman's, but in case it didn't work or something, they had her immediate contact, but the one in Malawi did not. Because they kind of really monitored, and every month those women were given cell phone cards. And it continued from the first day they came for a checkup when they were identified, and also for 6 weeks post-birth, like, you know, into the postpartum, they would get, excuse me, that. And it also, now they're thinking of expanding it to get the kids immunized too and to bring them. So this process, they've started it like 2 to 3 years ago, they have found pretty effective in Malawi. I hope I was able to answer your question. Thank you.
Can I add a comment to that?
Mm-hmm. Sure. I think one of the things you need to ask, and one of the problems with, you know, best practices and those ideas and what they do in Zanzibar, we're having trouble with here, is to go back to the basics of asking yourself and then the situation, why is this the problem here? Why are people always changing their cell phones? To which offhand I can think of a lot of answers, but is to ask your local community, how can, you know, the question is, we need to be able to communicate for your health care. Is the cell phone the way to do it with you? Do you keep the same number? If not, why not, which they may not answer because a lot of that has to do with drug dealing, is to go, what can we do about this? How can we solve this? And it's really to start with, this is the issue at hand, communication. How can we solve it? And to, since it's not working in your community, sit down with some people and have what amounts to a focus group, if not formally, then informally, to go, this seemed like a good idea, but it's not working, so what can we do? Why is it not working? And what can we do about it? And it may be that, you know, they will have one phone for their health communication, and then the changing numbers for everything else, but then you'll have to do something about assuring that nobody else gets that number to trace them. But it's to really go, why is back to the source, and go, why is this a problem and how can we solve it? And it's, that's the bottom up, not the top down. Your life is one thing and the way you do things is not going to work for your patients. And this is what I, you know, I said, what do you mean you don't have a refrigerator to keep the medicine cold? Well, everybody I know has refrigerators.
Yeah, I think Elvira wants to add something. Gopal, do you have some words of wisdom for us?
What I'd like to say is that telephones and mobile phones are tools. The most important thing is that the mother has a good relationship with the provider. So what I like to do is that there's a nurse and she has 500 pregnant mothers that she has a relationship with, and she knows where they live, what they eat, where they are, everything. And on top of that, they have the telephone number they can be reached. But nothing will substitute the relationship with the provider, in my opinion.
Thank you. I think you had a question, and then you, sir. Yeah, could you please identify yourself? Thank you so much.
My name is Goli Lamin from Nigeria. Now, it's not really a question, but I would like the people of the panel. There's a problem or challenge that we face with this global phenomenon of pushing for democratic governance. Well, that leads to having crops of leaders or politicians who don't understand the simple things, like the Haiti example, buying a sonar, an ultrasound, a simple ultrasound machine, getting the penicillin, getting the suppressor, or getting the penicillin. So what is democratization? It shows our leaders who don't get this information. And so it's a big challenge. And so I think this is also an area we need.
Thank you for your comment. That's really good. Before I, so far, would you like to add anything to that, please? Thank you.
Thank you for that excellent question. It's we all like technology. To give you one example of it, how many of you have gotten a new cell phone or a tablet or a laptop in the last, or a camera in the last 12 months? What happened to the old one? That's the answer. Is we all like technology, and once technology is, so to give you one example of that, we spend $2.7 trillion in the United States on healthcare. It's 17.9% of the GDP. The GDP of the United States is the largest of any nation on this planet. If you see how much we spend in terms of the actual telling people how to live healthy, how to modify behaviors which are risk factors, how to strengthen the protective risk factors, we spend about 1% of that. Is there evidence to show that if you take the top 10 leading causes of death in the United States, and this was not, the United States was not the leader, it came from Canada, Healthy Canada. They did this analysis, and then CDC did the analysis for the United States. If you take the top 10 leading causes of death, put them into four groups of factors, lifestyle factors, environment, biology, or genetic factors, and then healthcare system, 50% of it is lifestyle. 20% is environment, 20% is biology or genetic, and 10% is healthcare. But where do we put the money? If you are a politician, would you like to have, especially, and I come from a developing nation, if you are a politician, you might come from a small village. That village has to have a railroad station named after you. If you have a small place, you got to have a hospital named after you. The roads have to have a statue while living in every meeting place. So the people whom we choose to elect oftentimes come with great ideas. But once they reach the stage where they want to reach, they get entangled in bringing something to the masses without consulting the masses. Because some of these things, the best technology which I can think of is probably between our ears. It's called common sense, but rather difficult to find. So we got to go on advocating for this until the masses, that's us, with our help, with their help, we elect leaders who are willing to listen to people and address their issues, rather than trying to see what they can do to stay in the seat of power. Whether we call it autocratic, whether we call it communist, whether we call it democratic, the people still have their problems which will stay on, for not for years to come, but generations to come. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Ladies, anyone, or shall we take the next question?
I would just like to say that it's important to always work with all the local authorities, even before they become big names, and really have a very expanded education program involving everybody. Talk about your work. That's why it's so important that you really speak and really try to explain to everybody what you do it, why it matters. And that from the janitor to everybody. And so develop relationships with everybody, because you don't know where they're going to end up someday. And maybe 10, 30 years down the road, they have the opportunity to really make a much bigger impact. So politicians, the best way is to get them before they get big.
I think I just wanted to add one thing, which, you know, it came to my mind when after listening to Gopal and Amira, see the light went blink, like Gopal said. Yeah, so I just wanted to say that I think one of the things we need to really think about is involve the politicians even after they become politicians, because I found that when I was working in the UNFPA, when we talked about condom distribution in some of the countries which had, like, you know, the societies were a little more restrictive, when we said that we want to work with you, and again, we are, it's a transparent process, you're with us, so that we are not corrupting the youth by making them use condoms, but just to space, and this reflects that you are the one, like, give them the credit. Everybody loves to take the credit. So Gopal, when you said having a statue or a railway station named after you, so I think, by you, I mean the politician, yeah. So I think one of the things is that to say that this is the legacy you're leaving behind. So maybe that might work. That thought just came, because it helped us to get, you know, to promote safe sex and family planning at various levels. So again, I think that might help, like, you know, from top down. Yeah. And I think you, sir, yes, you had a question for anyone in particular?
That's you.
Okay.
My name is Ahmed Mohamed Ahmed. I also work for CSI Teaching Nigeria. And I'm really interested in the discussion started on the political cash transfer in India. And you talked about Zanzibar?
Yes.
Yeah. You started by how coaches will really give a lot of.
Because of the time,
yeah,
yes.
The program.
Yeah.
Simply because my country is also undertaking that kind of system. In two different perspectives. One, APGs, other national is also doing that. And then we have a coalition P, also taking up some other communities. But how fortunately is it trickle, you know, within the target community in that country? Secondly, we're also looking at the mobile technology that we're talking about. There should be a synergy with those interventions. And the resources are really limited.
Yeah.
And then if we didn't the synergy, that kind of activity, learn something about the program, and then I don't think
no, you're right. Thank you. You know, I have your card, so I'll be happy to send you the information. And the reason I just put the salient points from these two, because you know what to do, the lack of time, but I'll be happy. You have my information to give you, you know, that's why this is a great way of exchanging information. Would be happy to do that. And I have your email, and we can start the dialogue. Not that I didn't want to answer it now, but I think we'll go way beyond, but we'll be happy to give you more information in other places to what's being done. Thank you very much. Does anybody else have any questions for the rest of the panel? Okay, thank you so much, and have a great APHA. Yeah.
Yes, and you know, we'd request you to fill out the evaluation form and any suggestions for anything else, because I am the program co-chair for the APHA, and this year we got over 560 abstracts. And let me tell you, the whole process is very transparent. So we don't even know, like, I don't, mark, review my own abstract and say that I'm going to put it on. So just to let you know, we encourage those of you, especially with an interest in international health and our international colleagues, to please submit abstracts and students. So see you all next year in New Orleans, if not at one of the other sessions. Have a great day.